Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles, über alles in der Welt. Wenn es geht um Schutz und Flucht, brüderlich zusammenhält, von der Maas bis an
Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Jaeger bringing you the 13th and final installment of my reading of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945. It's a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. The original publication of this book in German was in 1979. 10 years later, in 1989, the English translation that I am using was released. To put this into perspective, this edition came out right before the fall of the Berlin Wall, which took place beginning in November 1989 and ending in October 1990. It wasn't until December 1991 that the Soviet Union was formally dissolved. I will be reading chapters 23 and 24 in this installment. Chapter 23 is titled Shipwrecked Survivors. Chapter 24 is titled Hospital Ships. So I begin with chapter 23. One of the most difficult tasks of the War Crimes Bureau consisted in clarifying the fate of German shipwrecked sailors and air crews downed in the ocean. In the majority of such cases, an investigation is impossible because there are no survivors and therefore no witnesses. The chances of surviving in a shark-infested sea are very limited, and even smaller if enemy planes or ships attack the wounded and drowning men. Nevertheless, the Bureau was able to collect at least 100 depositions from survivors of such incidents. In view of their testimony, one might be tempted to draw the conclusion that Anglo-American planes and warships attacked German shipwrecked personnel as a matter of course. Yet the thousands of Germans saved by American and British ships are proof that it was Anglo-American policy to rescue shipwrecked survivors. Sometimes Germans were taken on board, even though the presence of other German vessels endangered the rescuing vessel. As a rule, however, British and American cruisers and destroyers did not attempt rescues if there were German U-boats in the area, and rescues by submarine, given their limited space, were infrequent. In the evaluation of witness testimony, certain psychological considerations must be taken into account. The personal danger inherent in battle frequently distorts the perception of those who are fighting for their lives. Misinterpretation and exaggeration are by no means rare, and shipwrecked persons tend to assume that gunfire in their direction is aimed at them, disregarding the fact that there are frequently other legitimate military objectives in the immediate vicinity, perhaps including the ship they have abandoned. The situation is more serious, of course, if it is established beyond doubt that shooting has continued after the ship has gone down, or that shipwrecked are sufficiently far from other targets that any shooting in their vicinity can only be explained as being aimed at them. Are there any conceivable circumstances under which an attack upon shipwrecked survivors may be termed legitimate? In the specific case of the sinking of the Erik Giese near Narvik, Norway, in April 1940, the German naval war staff concluded that British destroyers had deliberately attacked the German survivors and surmised that, quote, "the British will try to justify their actions by stating that the customs of war permit shooting at shipwrecked crews if it is certain that in the absence of this use of arms and because of the nearness of enemy-occupied land, the shipwrecked would be immediately reintegrated into the enemy armed forces. Unquote. No official or unofficial British statement in support of this theory is known. Perhaps the German naval war staff assumed an unwritten order, in parentheses, by Desaias. Interestingly enough, there are indications that some officers of the United States Navy thought it valid to shoot at survivors if they could easily swim to the shore of enemy-held territory, even though it would seem that the answer to the dilemma would lie in rescuing and thereby capturing them. End of parentheses. That's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment there by Desaias. In the files of the War Crimes Bureau, there are many borderline cases where it is difficult to judge whether or not a violation of international law took place. In some, it appears that Allied forces actually did shoot at German shipwrecked survivors. Well, let me just comment on this first section here that Desaias always goes out of his way to give the benefit of the doubt to the Allies. The last thing he wants to be accused of in this book is to show any preference to the Germans. And when it comes to this period of history, of course, it is absolutely unacceptable to ever give any preference to Germans, even to the point of giving them less equal treatment and giving the Allies the benefit of the doubt in most all cases. And beyond the benefit of the doubt, really, the preferential treatment. So Desaias feels that he needs to make statements like this to make sure that people don't think that he's not being perfectly fair to the Allies. So the next section is headed Narvik. During the German invasion of Norway in the spring of 1940, one of the important strategic moves consisted in occupying the port of Narvik in the north, close to the 69th parallel. Hitler sent 10 destroyers full of troops and carried out a successful landing. In the meantime, however, 16 British destroyers and the battleship Warspite were on their way to Narvik and entered the fjords precisely as the empty German ships were setting out for their home port. In two major sea battles, on 10th and 13th April 1940, all 10 German destroyers were wiped out. Soon thereafter, the German press accused the British of shooting at German survivors desperately trying to swim ashore in the icy Norwegian waters. Realize these particular survivors would have been the crews of these destroyers, since the troops that they had brought there had already disembarked. It was through these press reports that the War Crimes Bureau first heard the allegations. On 25th June 1940, Maximilian Wagner wrote on behalf of the Bureau to the High Command of the Navy, requesting that depositions from witnesses be obtained. On 1st August, the Navy ordered a special court to examine the facts, putting Navy Judge Helmut Sieber in charge. Quote, "The investigations shall be carried out with the necessary thoroughness and expediency and shall be submitted directly to the High Command of the Navy." Unquote. On 8 August 1940, prior to Sieber's arrival in Wilhelmshaven, where most of the Narvik crews were stationed, the depositions of a number of survivors from the destroyer Anton Schmidt were obtained by a naval officer. Sieber's investigations followed on 15th and 16th August, including the interrogation of four crew members of the Erik Giza, which had been sunk on 13th April 1940. Since Captain Carl Schmidt, former commander of the Giza, had been reassigned to Navy headquarters in Paris, Judge Sieber was sent there to continue the investigations. On 27th August 1940, a preliminary report was transmitted to the Navy High Command in Berlin. It said, quote, "Prior to 6 August 1940, it was not possible to determine who had been shot at by the British in Narvik while swimming in the water, since the destroyer crews were either on leave or transferred. Before Judge Seaver was directed to investigate this matter, we had been able to determine that crew members of the destroyed Eric Giza and Georg Thiele, another ship, were involved. Also, the shipwrecked crew of the destroyer Anton Schmidt. Unquote. In the meantime, depositions from survivors of the other destroyers had been obtained on 22nd August, and the protocols were sent to Seaver. Pursuant to his orders, Seaver traveled to Swinemünde in Pomerania, where he obtained depositions from several officers and members of the crew of the Georg Thiele. On 10th September, he was back in Kiel to take the deposition of the Thiele's commander, Max Eckert Wolf. On 16th September, he forwarded the sworn protocols and a final report to the Navy High Command, which in turn forwarded the file to the War Crimes Bureau. Seaver's evaluation is characterized by a careful analysis of the legal situation. He concluded that a violation of international law had taken place only in the case of the Eric Giza. Interrogations in the other cases had established that the British artillery fire most probably was aimed at the destroyers, even though many sailors had been killed or injured by pom-pom fire and shrapnel. The distance from the attacking ships was so great that the gunfire could not reasonably be assumed to have been aimed at men in the water. This was also the opinion of Captain Friedrich Brumme, commander of the Anton Schmidt, who had been rescued by a Swedish cutter. He explained to Judge Seaver on 16th August, "Several members of my crew alleged that they had been shot at from British merchant ships. Later, we captured some 250 British sailors. There is no proof that they actually fired any shots. We did not find any weapons. It may be assumed that they threw them into the water as soon as they realized their hopeless situation. It is out of the question that the shooting observed by the crew could have come from the British warships, which lay at the entrance of the port. The distance was much too great. I estimate it at more than 3 kilometers. Unquote. Similarly, Captain Wolf of the Georg Thiele testified on 10 September, quote, "The distance to the British destroyers exceeded 4 kilometers during the shooting. It is obvious that shells would not only hit the destroyer, but also fall short or wide of the mark, and therefore it is understandable that the survivors swimming in the water were endangered." Unquote. Wolf went on to explain that the situation was entirely different with respect to shooting that took place after the survivors had reached the shore. As they started to climb the rugged fjord cliffs, 4-centimeter pom-poms and 12-centimeter shells exploded all around them. One shell burst in the middle of a group of survivors and killed 6. Wolf concluded, "It is clearly established that the British did not aim their fire at the abandoned destroyer, but at the crew members. It is important to note that the entire crew was unarmed and were only trying to save themselves and the wounded they were carrying." Unquote. Judge Seaver was of the opinion, however, that although shooting at defenseless survivors in the cliffs was certainly harsh, it did not entail a violation of international law. While it is prohibited to shoot at shipwrecked in the water, it is not expressly prohibited once they reach land, even if they are unarmed. This, he said, is analogous to land warfare, which permits shooting at the fleeing enemy whether or not he is armed. The event surrounding the sinking of the Eric Giza on 13th April 1940 presented an entirely different situation, as Captain Carl Schmidt explained during his Paris deposition on 23rd August 1940. Schmidt said, "While the crew of some 200 men was swimming in the water, the British destroyers opened fire against us with machine guns and cannons. Several times from the pressure in the water, I felt the explosion of a shell. However, I did not see anyone hit. The crew did suffer casualties through machine gun fire, which was clearly identifiable by its whistling sound." reports made to me by members of the crew after reaching land indicated that a number of soldiers had been hit. The civilian steward, Masula, was wounded by a shot that grazed his head, but the wound did not endanger his life. Several days after the battle, the engine man, Ospelkaus, was washed ashore. We saw that he had been shot in the head, a wound which he could only have received in the water. The report submitted immediately after the battle clearly established that several soldiers were killed while swimming in the water. Those who had been swimming in their vicinity observed that their heads were suddenly all bloody, and they ceased moving. According to undisputed testimony, the British also directed heavy fire at the rafts, even one raft that had no oars and simply floated in the fjord. The British did take 9 men prisoner from this raft. Schmidt emphasized that the continued shooting was aimed exclusively at the shipwrecked, since, quote, after abandoning ship, there was no belligerent activity on the German side, not even from the shore, unquote. He concluded, quote, it would have been easy for the British to rescue the survivors from the water and thereby prevent them from rejoining the German troops in Narvik, unquote. So, instead of rescuing them, they preferred to shoot them. The sailor Joseph Vilnius testified on 16th August 1940, quote, a British destroyer fired at us while we were swimming. The shots could be seen and heard. They fell in the midst of us. About 500 meters from land, I heard my comrade, sailor Redderman, call out. I saw that he was bleeding in the head. I called him, and he did not answer. He did not move anymore, unquote. Engine man Heinz Bacchus stated on 17th August 1940, quote, I saw continuous foam spraying from the machine gun bullets as they hit the water. I am convinced that this fire was exclusively intended to hit the crew of the Erik Giza, since nowhere in the vicinity was there either a German or a neutral ship. We were the last destroyer. And on land, there were no German resistance nests. I myself saw a comrade hit by a bullet in the water. His head sank, and he did not swim anymore. We were very upset about the behavior of the British, since we had rescued 20 shipwrecked British sailors 3 days before, on 10 April, unquote. Among those German sailors who were hit in the water was Joseph Lynn. After we had abandoned ship and were swimming toward land, he recalled on 7th May 1974, I was hit by a bullet in the upper arm, but I did not experience any pain since the extremely cold water had a numbing effect. When I reached the land, I was unable to climb ashore and had to be pulled out of the water. Other members of the crew stated that they saw the British shoot at a raft carrying, among others, Captain Ernst Günther Prey and the ship's doctor. It was this raft without oars that the British intercepted some 2 hours later, thereby capturing the survivors. Captain Prey survived the war to become German naval attaché in London. On 10th April 1974, he recalled the rescue operations. Quote, our first artillery officer and the second watchkeeper in their life jackets were killed right next to me by machine gun fire. I know with certainty that at the time of the shooting, our ship was silent. The battle had already ended. The British destroyer Foxhound later approached our raft and later sent out a cutter to pick us up and bring us on board. That was the ship's doctor and 2 or 3 crew members, unquote. 2 other rafts were also attacked by British destroyers before being intercepted by the Foxhound, which arrived later on the scene and had not been involved in the shooting. The attackers were probably the Bedouin and the Cossack, although their logs do not provide any indication that they had shot at shipwrecked Germans. A report of 16 April 1940 from the British destroyer Icarus reacted to the German allegations that British destroyers had attacked shipwrecked German sailors. Although the Icarus had not been engaged in battle with the Eric Giza, it had heard a British radio message to the Foxhound, which said, "If you are not otherwise engaged, pick up any Germans in the water." The Icarus regarded this message as a confirmation of the traditional British policy of rescuing survivors and therefore a refutation of the German charges. The fact that the Foxhound did in fact rescue survivors, however, does not exclude the possibility that other destroyers may have behaved differently. In view of the unanimous testimony of the surviving crew of the Eric Giza immediately after the events, and their consistent assertions ever since, it appears certain that they were indeed attacked while they were swimming ashore. The reconstructed log of the Eric Giza also contains a succinct and matter-of-fact entry. Quote, "The enemy opened machine gun fire upon the survivors swimming in the water. Several soldiers were hit. One of the survivors, who was wounded superficially by a bullet that grazed his head, reached the shore." Unquote. This was the steward, Eric Mansula, who told Judge Felix Reich on 5th November 1940, quote, "I myself received two superficial wounds on the back of the head. The corpse of our civilian cook, Bernhard Machens, was later fished out of the water. He had received a shot through the head. I cannot suppose that the British machine gun fire could have been aimed at any other objective than us." Unquote. It is interesting to compare these sober descriptions with the propagandistic tone of such contemporary publications as the Navy newspaper, Die Kriegsmarine, which attempted to recreate the atmosphere with a strong emotional appeal and much rhetorical embellishment. It read, "Last to abandon his ship was the commander. Three red rafts had been thrown overboard, and now the survivors of the brave crew drifted, some of them on rafts, the others swimming, 1,000 meters from shore. The British destroyers turn around. Surely they want to rescue the shipwrecked, take them on board, as one owes to a courageous enemy, as this very crew had done for the survivors of the Hunter. But no, the incredible comes to pass. The British approach the men drifting in the water in order to liquidate them with machine guns. Not only that, they even direct their machine gun fire at those lucky ones who had reached shore, who thought themselves saved. These are fiends who want to appear as decent seamen, as civilized men. Shots through the head and on the back of the neck are proof of this new British atrocity." Well, it's true. But, continuing with Josias, "It is not known whether the German government submitted an official protest note to the British government. However, the voluminous records of the Sieber and Reich investigations were evaluated by the War Crimes Bureau, and on 28th January 1941, Johannes Golsche delivered a speech to the German Association for Military Politics and Military Sciences, called Violations of International Law by the Enemy in the Present War, in which he dealt extensively with the Eric Giza case. This material was also incorporated in a bulky study prepared by the Bureau titled Violations of the Laws of War by the British Armed Forces. The next section is titled The Osia Paraskevi. It's spelled P-A-R-A-S-K-E-V-I, and it's Greek. One of the gravest instances of shooting at German shipwrecked survivors took place in May 1941 in the Aegean, shortly before the commencement of the German assault on Crete. Judge Georg Prechtel obtained depositions on 18th May 1941 from six witnesses of the event, the Greek captain and the crew of the kayak Osia Paraskevi. An interpreter named Felix Ruggiero assisted. According to the kayak's owner, that's a type of sea-going vessel, kayak, its owner, Ioannis Mamalukas, said, On 12th May 1941, my ship, Osia Paraskevi, a caique weighing 35 tons, sailed to Kavala under orders of the German port commander of Castron, otherwise Chios, on the island of Lemnos. We sailed out at 8 in the morning. On board were Captain Theodoros Mamoulakis, my uncle, myself, three sailors, Twistwellikis, Kalaris, and Daniel, the engine man, Nestoa, two Greek civilians, and four German soldiers, to wit, an officer, a non-commissioned officer, and two men. Around 12 noon, the ship was some 35 kilometers, or 20 miles, northwest of Castron. Suddenly, at a distance of about 1,000 meters, a submarine came up behind us and fired three shots over the ship. I ordered my ship to stop immediately. The German officer gave the captain his shirt and told him to signal with it. In the meantime, the submarine had approached to about 20 meters. One of five or six men on the tower of the submarine shot with his pistol at the German officer, who then descended with the other three soldiers below deck. The man on the tower with a full beard spoke to us in a foreign tongue and by gesticulating ordered us to go on the lifeboats and to move away from the ship. We recognized it as English because of the way it sounded, since we as seamen had frequently been together with British sailors and had heard them speak. At first we had thought it was an Italian submarine, but it could not be since we know the sound of Italian very well. While the crew and the Greek passengers were still on board, the German soldiers also came out from below deck. The officer and a soldier with eyeglasses were in uniform, the other two in swimming trunks. They were threatened from the submarine tower with a machine gun, and the bearded man signaled them to go back below deck. At this point, my crew and I went on the lifeboat and paddled away from our ship. At about the same time, the submarine started moving backward. When we were some 10 meters away from the Osia Paraskevi, the cannon on the tower started shooting. The first round must have hit the caique below water, since it went up in flames, and the German soldiers, whose clothing was already burning, emerged from the inside of the boat. They did not get around to jumping overboard, since the boat suddenly sank under them. After the ship disappeared, the four Germans were swimming. Then the machine gun on the tower opened fire on the shipwreck and continued shooting until each German had been hit and sank beneath the water. Wow, what a story. Judge Prechtel obtained similar depositions from the other five Greek witnesses who took the oath in the Greek Orthodox manner, which is, I swear by God to have spoken the whole truth. On 26 May 1941, the High Command of the German Navy sent the depositions to the War Crimes Bureau. Meanwhile, the case had also come to the attention of the German press, which exploited it for propaganda purposes. Well, why not? I say. It occasioned vigorous accusations against the British government at a press conference in the German Foreign Office in Berlin on 4th July 1941. It appears that the British submarine involved was the Rorqual. We read in its log for 12th May 1941, Rorqual went alongside and it was seen that there were Greeks in the caique. After much shouting and gesticulating, they were induced to abandon ship into the boat, and one round of HE was fired into the caique at 50 yards range. There was a big explosion with great flames and most of the caique disintegrated. The bow remained above surface for about 30 seconds, and a dozen or so, there was only four of them, but they say a dozen or so German soldiers in uniform rushed up the hatch amid the flames, shrieking horribly and afraid to jump into the water. The explosion was a heavy one, and there must have been explosives aboard the caique, and it seems likely that there were more German soldiers below who were killed by the explosion. There were no German survivors. End of that report. Judging by the date, location, and description of the events, it is almost certain that the Rorqual report corresponds to the case investigated by Judge Prechtel. even though no mention is made in the British log of shooting at survivors. The German version gains in credibility to the extent that the witnesses were all Greeks and not a priori anti-British. There are close parallels to the Barralong case in World War I, when American sailors were the witnesses. It is regrettable that the Greek survivors of the Ostia Paraskevi were never questioned after the war. On 26 July 1978, however, Judge Georg Prechtl recalled the depositions made 37 years before because, quote, the case had caused a stir with much indignation. At the time, I was the judge of the 164th Infantry Division, and in this capacity, I was ordered by the High Command of the 12th Army by telegram, dated 17 May 1941, to interrogate the Greek witnesses. After so many years, I cannot make precise statements on the witnesses, but it is certain that according to established practice, I would not have taken their depositions if they had not seemed credible to me. The location of the deposition was, according to my notes, the town of Zenthi, northeast of Kavala, unquote. The next section is headed Crete. The German invasion of Crete began just a week after the Paraskevi incident. The attack was primarily carried out by paratroopers, but 2,331 additional troops were to be brought to the island by sea. This endeavor proved to be a disaster for the Germans. The caiques were intercepted by the Royal Navy, and most were sunk or burned in the night of 21st-22nd May 1941. According to unpublished German figures, however, only 327 of the soldiers aboard them lost their lives. The majority of the shipwrecked were able to reach one of the Aegean islands. Nevertheless, many of the survivors reported having been attacked while they were swimming in the water. Others, whose caiques had not been destroyed, witnessed the machine gunning of lifeboats by the British. Corporal Walter Segel stated before Judge Sauerman, "Together with my troops, I went on board a Greek caique on 17 May 1941, and we sailed from Piraeus in order to land on the western shore of Crete on 20th May to give support to the parachute troops. We sailed in a convoy of 21 ships that was attacked by British warships near Crete in the night of 20 to 21 May from 22:10 in the night until 0330 in the early morning, 3:30. The British scanned the seas with searchlights, attacked individual ships with artillery fire, and after sinking them, switched on smaller searchlights to look for the shipwrecked who were holding on to rubber boats or similar gear, and opened fire on them with machine guns and small caliber cannons. I could observe the shooting clearly. Individual men in such rubber boats suddenly sank. The British did not even attempt to rescue any of them. I saw at least 20 groups of survivors who were illuminated by the British and then sprayed with bullets. My own ship that had the number 107 or 103 was only lightly damaged. On 26 May, Judge Oscar von Jagwitz interrogated Willie Wall, a survivor of the caique S3, which had been sunk on 21st May around 23:30 hours. Willie said, "Since the searchlights had repeatedly illumined our lifeboat, we tried to move far away. After about 2 hours, a British warship found us with its searchlights and attacked us with machine guns and artillery fire. We threw ourselves down on the bottom of the rubber boat to give the impression that it was empty. We clearly heard the bullets whistle past, and the artillery shells hit the water close to us. Yet neither the boat nor those in it were hit. In the meantime, rough seas had come up, so that we frequently disappeared in the waves. During the night, we rescued 4 comrades from another ship, who told me that they had tried to swim to a warship in order to be rescued. They abandoned this intention after they saw that the ship they had supposed was Italian was in fact British and opened fire on the rubber boats and on the swimmers. A survivor of the Kayak S-12, Sergeant Carl Repp, told Judge Roland Rudel that many soldiers in the water cried out for help. The British shot at them too, and the cries for help were silenced. I can state with certainty that this shelling could only hit the shipwrecked, since in the direction of the shooting there were no larger ships of the 1st Marine Squadron, unquote. And a sailor from another kayak, Ernst Stribney, reported to Judge Joachim Schultz on 28 May 1941 that despite his ship's white flag, six British ships opened fire on it and continued to shoot at the men who jumped into the water and tried to swim away. Heavy machine gun fire, quote, sprayed all around us for several minutes. I was wounded in my right shoulder. We suffered the most from the heavy cruiser, which moved crisscross amid the shipwreck and continuously shot at us. And in its wake, many comrades were pulled into the depths by the suction of the propellers. The British did not rescue a single man. Unquote. A similar case had already been reported to Judge Schultz by Lieutenant Walter Hanglein on 23rd May 1941. He had been on a two-masted Greek fishing boat with some 80 mountain infantry troops. We unfurled a white towel at the stern, and most of the crew signaled with white handkerchiefs. The English must have seen these signs of surrender, since they were at a distance of 150 to 200 meters, and we clearly saw that they were watching us with binoculars. Nevertheless, they shot some 10 to 15 shells from a cannon with caliber 2.5 or 3.7 centimeter. The shells hit the deck and wounded some 20 men. We tried to bring the wounded below deck and were then hit by 7.5 centimeter shell that destroyed the infirmary room and everything in it. I ordered abandoned ship and was the last man to jump into the water. When I had swum some 50 meters from our boat, machine gun bullets splashed in a semicircle around me. Unquote. Corporal Carl Grimm, a survivor of the same boat, added, "They fired mainly with machine guns, but also with artillery. My feet were repeatedly lifted by the water pressure caused by the shells that exploded around me. A comrade swimming directly next to me was hit in the head by a machine gun bullet and sank. I estimate that at least 10 men were killed in the water. It is almost incredible that anyone survived." Unquote. A sailor named Valentin Zaremba completed the picture. Quote, "At first I saw some 50 men swimming about. A quarter of an hour later we were only 22. All missing comrades were victims of British bullets. The sea was completely calm and everybody had a life vest so that actually no one could have drowned. We were especially upset that the British stood along the entire railing and watched how we were individually liquidated. The shooting lasted something like a quarter of an hour." Unquote. The Kayak S-109 was attacked around 9:30 on the morning of 22nd May. Judge Rudel took the deposition of the ship's doctor, Ernst Thalheim, who described an attack on his lifeboat. "We were some 400 meters away from our ship. The British cruiser was at a distance of 700 to 1,000 meters. No one in our rubber boat was wounded or killed, but three air cells were hit by the shell, so that one side of the boat sank deeper into the water. Neither from our ship nor from the rubber boats did anyone shoot at the British, nor did we have any weapons at all in the lifeboat. One more thing, our ship was shelled after the white flag had been hoisted." Unquote. The logs of the British Navy report the sinking of many German kayaks in the Mediterranean in the month of May 1941, but contain no reference to the shooting of the shipwrecked Germans. After the invasion of Crete, the frequency of German reports of British attacks on shipwrecked soldiers decreased notably. One of these later reports was made on 15 September 1941 by Gunner Rudolf Grobach to Judge Wilhelm Lanswehr. Quote, "On 8th July 1941, I had been assigned to the machine gun area of the Kike LV that was bringing vacationers from Chania to the continent. Around 3 a.m., a British submarine came up and fired a cannon shot at our Kike, hitting the engine. The Kike stopped but did not sink. The entire crew and passengers put on life vests and jumped overboard. The British submarine sent a detail to our Kike and blew it up with explosives. While we were swimming in the water, the British submarine shot at us with machine guns for about 15 minutes. The British used tracer bullets. Two men were killed and two seriously wounded. I myself was wounded superficially in the head. Another survivor of the same ship, Corporal Alios Falder, reported to Judge Hokage, quote, "The submarine shot at the rubber boats and at the crew swimming nearby with tracer ammunition. Then the gunner changed his aim and shot directly at us. We submerged our heads and the bullets swept over us," unquote. The next section is headed Air Attacks. The files of the War Crimes Bureau disclose that shipwrecked German survivors were shelled not only by enemy warships, but sometimes also by enemy airplanes. Frequently, the victims were not only German sailors, but also German air crews whose planes had been shot down over the sea. A typical case was reported by Horst Buchholz, whose plane was shot down by British Spitfires on 19 August 1942 over Dieppe, France. In his deposition before Judge Piest, Buchholz stated, quote, "Our wireless operator, Petty Officer Eiger, and I came down some 3 kilometers from the shore, threw off our parachutes, and rendered our swimming vests serviceable. We tried to swim to shore, but made very slow progress owing to the strong ebb tide and also because Eiger was wounded. Several Spitfires flew at a height of about 10 meters and fired constantly at us in the water. They must have hit Eiger, who was swimming behind me, because I heard him call out my name, but I could not see him anymore. I assumed that his swimming vest was hit and that he immediately went down. In my opinion, the Spitfires attacked us deliberately and not by accident, there being no other military objectives around." Unquote. Several other German planes were shot down over Dieppe on the same day, and Corporal Hugo Lemser reported a similar Spitfire attack. Quote, "I saw the bullets hit the water. I tried to dive but could hardly go down because of the life vest. There is no doubt at all that the British fighter deliberately attacked me since there were no other objectives in my direction. There were no ships or boats in my vicinity." Unquote. Numerous incidents of this kind were reported in the Mediterranean, especially after the Allied invasion of Italy. On 21st June 1944, a rescue launch was attacked and sunk by American fighter planes, which then continued to strafe the survivors, Corporal Fritz Schiedlauske and the Italian pilot Umberto Pagan. Corporal Schiedlauske reported, quote, "At 9 a.m. I was ordered to rescue shipwrecked. My comrades and I sailed on an Italian fishing boat with Red Cross markings. Size of the boat, 10 meters long, 2 meters wide. Size of the Red Cross, 1 square meter. American fighter planes flew over us until about 11 a.m. We held up the Red Cross in the flight direction, and the planes turned around and flew toward the coast. A second fighter squadron flew over us and took objectives on land under fire, but then they turned around and flew out to sea, went into position by looping over us and opened fire even though we waved the Red Cross flag at them. The boat sank. We were 4 in the crew. 2 were killed and 2 seriously wounded. Even while we were swimming in the water, gravely wounded, the planes attacked us again. I cannot say with certainty how many approaches they flew over us." Unquote. Umberto Pagan provided a more poignant description. He said, quote, "On 21st June 1944, my brother and I rushed with 2 German soldiers to rescue German shipwrecked. The Red Cross that we flew was plainly visible to the American fighter planes, but they strafed us with machine gun fire. My brother and a German soldier died instantly. The other German and I were seriously wounded. In spite of our wounds, we jumped into the water since our boat was sinking. The Americans continued their attack and wounded us again. The fighter pilots, who saw that German comrades were coming to rescue us, shot at them, too. Unquote. The next section is headed British Policy. There is no doubt that official British policy was in keeping with the laws of war, but this did not preclude discussion of the limits of the laws of war in the British ministries, particularly discussion of the possible military advantages of a harsher policy toward shipwrecked enemy crews. Early in 1943, the German submarine commander Hans Dietrich von Tiesenhausen, who had been rescued by a British destroyer after his submarine was sunk, submitted a protest to the British government and asked that it be forwarded to the protecting power. He alleged that after his submarine had shown the white flag, British planes continued the attack and machine-gunned the shipwrecked crew. Von Tiesenhausen's report was considered at a British Foreign Office meeting on 3rd June 1943. Legal advisor Patrick Dean, who chaired the meeting, advised against forwarding the report to the protecting power. He had already argued at the Air Ministry on 14 May 1943 that an airplane cannot capture a submarine, it can only sink it. The surrender of such vessels should not be accepted unless Allied surface craft in the immediate vicinity are in a position to ensure their capture. In all other circumstances, the attack should be pressed home in spite of the flying of a white flag. It has been agreed that for operational reasons, this policy should, as far as possible, be concealed from the German government. If it became known to them, they might institute reprisals against captured British seamen. Unquote. Yet Dean did not succeed in having his point of view adopted. Instead, the Air Ministry drafted very clear instructions for fighter planes. Quote, in no circumstances is the crew of a U-boat in the water to be subjected to any form of attack. Unquote. On 28 May 1943, Dean objected that, quote, circumstances can be imagined, for example, when a U-boat crew are swimming from their sunk or damaged U-boat to an enemy war vessel, where one would have thought that attack upon them from the air was justifiable. Unquote. Dean's point of view parallels the German hypothesis with respect to Narvik, that the crews of British destroyers considered it justifiable to shoot at the German shipwreck because any German sailors who reached land would be incorporated into the German forces there. And it may be that the British destroyers in Narvik acted according to this unwritten policy, but other attacks on shipwrecked survivors were less easily rationalized. A case in point was the machine gunning of the shipwrecked crew of the U-852 by four British fighter planes on 3rd May 1944 near Bender Bila, Somaliland, which was in British hands so that there was no danger whatsoever that the German crew would join other German forces on land. In fact, the survivors were all taken prisoner shortly after the landing. This incident is not devoid of historical irony. It was this very U-boat that 2 months earlier, on 13 March 1944, had sunk the steamer Pellas in the Atlantic and machine-gunned a number of Greek survivors. After the war, in criminal proceedings before a British military court in Hamburg, the commander of the U-852, Heinz Eck, defended his actions on grounds of operational necessity, arguing that Allied air surveillance was very intensive in the Atlantic, and that late in 1943, four German U-boats had been discovered in the same area and sunk by fighter planes. He contended that he had never ordered the killing of survivors. Rather, he gave an order to destroy all floating wreckage to prevent Allied planes from using it to find and destroy his ship, even though he knew that a number of shipwrecked would be hit by the shelling and that those not hit would have a much smaller chance of surviving without the larger floating objects to cling to. In fact, three Greek sailors did survive to testify against X. The British court rejected his defense of operational necessity and sentenced him and two of his officers, Lieutenant August Hoffman and the ship's doctor, Walter Weisswenning, to death. The court also refused to consider the Bender Byla incident, which the defense had not failed to mention. Evidently, a tu-quoque defense was psychologically impossible at the time. That's the end of the chapter on shipwreck survivors, and I want to comment that Desai's last sentence here just shows how weak he is. In even though he gives all the evidence, he says, well, it sounds weak to me. He's using irony, saying that evidently it was psychologically impossible at the time to be, well, what you'd say would be what I said earlier, to be fair to the Germans. No, he couldn't be fair to the Germans. So here you had the British able to carry on anti-German trials in Hamburg against Germans, and naturally the Germans aren't going to have a chance. And anything that the British have done, similarly, is not going to be brought up, not allowed to be brought up, and it's not going to make any difference. So this is what we find even in this book. As I've said before, I'm very grateful to Desaius for putting this book together. It was a big job, and he's very good at doing this kind of work. And I know he wants to be fair to Germany, but he's under the pressure of the, as he calls it here, the psychology of the time, which says, well, you better not make the Germans look good or nobody's going to publish your book. This is just the way it was. So we have to deal with this in this book. And now I'm going to go to chapter 24, titled Hospital Ships, which is quite a bit shorter than chapter 23. Pursuant to their declared policy, the British Navy and Royal Air Force regularly attacked the smaller German hospital ships, though finally in 1944 they did recognize the Erlangen, which was a 3,509-ton ship. And early in 1945, the Freiburg, both of which they had earlier attacked. British warships also disturbed the traffic of German hospital ships by forcing them to take a certain course or by detaining them for weeks and even months, as indicated in the records of the German Navy, although not always in the Bureau's files. Moreover, though the British did attack primarily the smaller hospital ships, every now and then a larger ship was also hit. British pilots evidently had some difficulty in deciding which ships enjoyed immunity. In May 1943, the Bureau compiled a list of those that had been bombarded, comprising 9 German hospital ships and 10 Italian hospital ships, including the sinking of the Po, Arno, California, Giuseppe Orlando, and San Giusto. As the bombardment of hospital ships continued, the Bureau compiled a second list of 24 cases covering the period from May 1943 to December 1944, including thoroughly documented attacks on the Erlangen on 13 and 15 June 1944 and on the Freiburg on 14 August 1944. On the basis of these records, the German government submitted protest notes to the British government. For instance, a note of 1st November 1944 described attacks on the Höxter, Innsbruck, Erlangen, Bonn, and Saturnus, as well as upon hospital trains bearing the Red Cross. The most significant case on the Bureau's list was the sinking of the Tübingen, 3,509 tons, on 18 November 1944 at 7:45 hours GMT, Central European Time, near Pola, south of Cape Promontor in the Adriatic. The case was all the more remarkable considering that Great Britain had recognized the Tübingen as a hospital ship and the British Mediterranean Command knew its exact course. Yet two British bow fighter planes attacked and sank it. Apparently, the sinking came as a surprise to the British Foreign Office. In the afternoon of the same day, it communicated the news to the Swiss government as protecting power. The Swiss telephoned the German legation in Bern, which in turn cabled the German Foreign Office in Berlin. Quote, hospital ship Tübingen, pursuant to assurances given, sailed on 17 November from Bari to Trieste. British authorities have been informed that the hospital ship was attacked in the early hours of today by a British plane and severely damaged. The British have ordered an immediate investigation. You know, the RAF ought to court-martial the pilot that did that, but they won't. They will accept his excuses. Let's see if they do. The British government sent a second, more extensive note to the protecting power on 19 November 1944, 2 days later. The official German protest followed on 24 November. The German protest read, on 18 November 1944, at 7:45 hours near Pola, the German hospital ship Tübingen was attacked by two double-engined British bombers with machine guns and bombs so that it sank, although the course of the hospital ship had been communicated to the British government well in advance of its voyage to Saloniki and back for the purpose of transporting wounded German soldiers. Numerous members of the crew were thereby killed and wounded. The German government emphatically protests the serious violations of international law committed by the sinking of the hospital ship Tübingen. The German government demands that the British government take all necessary measures to prevent the recurrence of such undoubtedly deliberate violations of international law. It further reserves the right to draw the appropriate consequences of this and many other violations of international law, especially such as were communicated to the Swiss legation in Berlin by a verbal note of 1 November 1944. This note was forwarded to London by the Swiss on 27 November 1944. The British Air Ministry had already ordered an inquiry on 18 November 1944, and on 29 November, the British Foreign Office informed its legation in Bern that an investigation of the case was in progress. On 19 November, the Royal Air Force headquarters in the Mediterranean had telegraphed the Air Ministry, quote, the report is too long and intricate to lend itself to summarizing it in a signal. But the incident was the result of a curious mixture of bad luck and stupidity. Huh. Oh, sure. Unquote. It appears that though a chain of errors on the part of the British pilots and a misunderstanding in the wireless transmission, the order was in fact given to attack the ship. The official British answer submitted in Germany on 4 December 1944 explained that, quote, four aircraft circled the ship, but as the leader was still unable to identify her, he decided to signal sighting details to base and to request instructions. For technical reasons, he was unable to transmit the signal himself, and he therefore instructed the second aircraft in his section to do so. The captain of the second aircraft had identified the ship as a hospital ship, and incorrectly assumed that his leader had done so too. He supposed, however, that there must be some special circumstances justifying an exception from standing orders prohibiting attacks on hospital ships, and transmitted a message to the following effect. His message was 1HS350, meaning one hospital ship, course 350 degrees, and giving her position. Owing to atmospheric conditions, this message was received to base incorrectly and read to the following effect, 1HSI-350, one high-speed launch course 350 degrees, with a position in the middle of the Gulf of Venice. A second version of this message showing the position of the ship as overland in the Istrian Peninsula and requesting instructions was later retransmitted to another station, but it again incorrectly referred to a high-speed launch. Oh my, you know, oh, they just have to make these mistakes. These British, they're just so incompetent, aren't they? These messages were then brought to the notice of the controlling officer, who ascertained that no Allied high-speed launch was in the position indicated in the first version of the message, which was in any case many miles from the Tubingen's position, and gave orders to attack. On receipt of these orders, the leader, who was still unaware that the ship was a hospital ship, instructed his section to attack. It was not until he passed over the ship after completing his attack that he distinguished the name Tubingen on her side and realized her identity. His Majesty's government have given instructions that the circumstances attending this attack shall be fully investigated at a court of inquiry with a view to preventing any similar incident, and that if the facts disclosed justify such a course, appropriate disciplinary action shall be taken. Of course it wasn't. Although, as stated above, His Majesty's government regret the sinking of the ship in the circumstances described, they cannot refrain from remarking, oh man, now listen to this. Although, as stated above, His Majesty's government regret the sinking of the ship in the circumstances described, they cannot refrain from remarking that had the Tubingen been properly illuminated at the time of sighting, in accordance with international practice, the leader of the section would have had no difficulty in identifying her as a hospital ship, and the incident would thus have been avoided. They trust that care will be taken to ensure that in the future all German hospital ships are illuminated in poor visibility in such a way as to leave no doubt as to their identity. Unquote. As was to be expected, the German authorities too devoted considerable time to investigating the circumstances of the sinking. On 23rd December 1944, ship's captain Wolfgang Dietrich Hermitchen, first officer Gunther Quiddel, and the third officer, Heinrich Bruns, made sworn statements before German Navy Judge Franz Nadenau. On 29 December, they were followed by Chief Engineer Ernst Frenz, Second Officer Martin Messick, and Third Engineer August Glander. The statement of Captain Hermitchen cast doubt on part of the British version. Here we go. Both British planes flew 60 to 70 meters right over our ship. With the unaided eye, I saw the British colors on the fuselage. Even if the planes had not recognized us before as a hospital ship, something which I think out of the question because of the extraordinarily good visibility, at the very latest, at this moment, they must have realized that we were a hospital ship. After both planes had flown over the ship, they turned around and flew one by one over the ship, one plane from starboard and the other from port, and attacked us again. The bombardment was repeated about six times from starboard and about three times from port. Unquote. Obviously, a key question is whether the ship was immediately identifiable, as the Germans claimed, or whether the visibility was impaired, as the British contended. Second Officer Martin Messick, who was responsible for illumination, explained, quote, shortly after 7 a.m., I ordered our electrician, Kesenick, to turn off the night illumination. The sun had risen already about 6:30 a.m. During my watch, the weather did not change. After sunrise, we had perfectly calm weather. Shortly after 7 a.m., after the night illumination had been turned off, four fighter bombers circled over us, yet they turned around and flew southward. They were clearly British planes. I saw their colors. Unquote. According to the Germans, the ship was attacked between 7:45 and 8:05 a.m. and sank at 8:20. There was enough time to put down lifeboats, and two members of the crew, sailors Tilner and Huer, were able to take pictures of the sinking ship. The photographs which survived the war show good visibility and calm seas. Well, there you go. The British are lying. They're making up a story to protect their pilots. That's what they do. And they've done it before. I mean, this has come up previously in my reading of this book where the British have been shown to be dishonest when they have committed a crime, a war crime, you'd call it, and they don't want to admit it. So they just don't. They make something up. And you can't prove, well, he's got these photographs. So we go on. On the basis of these depositions, the high command of the German Navy submitted a preliminary report to the German Foreign Office rejecting the British allegations. Quote, "The note's contention that the incident would have been avoided if the Tübingen had been duly illuminated can only be termed an inadequate excuse, considering that a German court has now taken statements from the captain of the Tübingen as well as the first and third officers, according to whom a mistake about the identity of the ship as a hospital ship was completely out of the question because of the clear weather." Unquote. The German Foreign Office then transmitted a second protest note on 29 January 1945. Well, just think, January 1945, none of the Allies think they have to go along with any of this. They know they're soon going to be the victors, so they don't need to accept any protests that the Germans are making. And that's what their attitude, no doubt, was. Anyway, this second protest reads, quote, "The investigation which the German government has carried out does not support the British hypothesis that the sinking of the hospital ship occurred because of a chain of errors, the first link of which was the incorrect behavior of the hospital ship. According to sworn testimony by German witnesses, the circumstances were as follows. On 18 November, the Tübingen was on its way from Bari to Trieste in the North Adriatic Sea. During the entire voyage, the ship made transmissions on radio and on the 600-meter wave so that the enemy knew its general location. Shortly after 7 a.m. Central European time, four single-engine fighter bombers, which were identified as British, flew over the hospital ship, which was duly painted as such. The planes circled and flew southward without carrying out any attack. The weather was clear, there were no clouds, the sea was calm, there was practically no wind. The sun had just risen when around 7:45 a.m. Central European time, two double-engine British Boston III bombers approached the Tübingen from the south. The planes circled over the ship and opened fire with rockets and machine guns. The attack lasted almost 15 minutes, during which the planes flew over the ship at a height of 30 to 60 meters, that's not very high, bombarding it 12 times. The planes left the scene only after they saw that the ship was lost. In the light of these facts, there is no doubt whatever that the crews of both attacking planes knew that the ship they were attacking was a hospital ship. There is no room here for the possibility that they might have been in error. The allegation is equally untrue that the Tübingen was not sufficiently illuminated when the first four fighter bombers sighted it. Because of the very clear weather, the Tübingen was at this time unmistakably recognizable as a hospital ship, even from a great distance." Unquote. A communication of the High Command of the German Navy to the War Crimes Bureau indicated that the casualties were one dead, three missing and presumed dead, including the ship's medical officer, Dr. Newman, and 16 wounded. Faced with the problem of whether to answer this second more emphatic note, with the war nearing its end and the German collapse only a matter of weeks away, the British Foreign Office decided to do nothing. Quote, "We feel here that little good will be done by continuing the controversy, and that if any reply is considered necessary, it should be confined to a reassertion of the facts set out in our note to the Germans." Unquote. There are still a number of open questions about the sinking of the Tübingen, and German and British opinions still differ. On 18 August 1976, Captain Permichin reiterated his supposition that the British attack was deliberate and that it served a very good military purpose. The hospital ship service in the Adriatic was very necessary to take the pressure off the railway between Trieste and Montenegro. Without hospital ships, the wounded would have had to be transported by rail or plane, thus using facilities that were sorely needed for the war effort. This theory has some persuasive value, considering that the British apparently had a concerted policy of hindering German hospital ship service as much as possible. For example, by repeatedly detaining them, as it did the Grandiska, Freiburg, Bonn, and Constanz in port for weeks at a time. On the other hand, the inquiry carried out by the British Air Ministry makes credible the possibility that a chain of errors... did in fact take place, that unusual circumstances accounted for the regrettable sinking of the hospital ship. No official order to sink the Tubingen has ever been found. Well, why would there be an order? It's just these pilots who made that decision. And British policy is quite unequivocally against the bombardment of Red Cross vehicles and vessels. British documents not intended for publication or for use in war propaganda clearly show that both the Air Ministry and the Foreign Office were surprised and embarrassed by the event. The fact that they were surprised and embarrassed, what that means is that these pilots, and particularly this one pilot, this lead pilot, made this decision on his own. And then later, he said, oh, they couldn't see and so on. And the British took advantage of that and used his story. They didn't want to prosecute one of their pilots. So they didn't care about the Germans. They cared about their own. This is so transparent. As the Germans know, they had their own people's testimony, and it makes sense. It all fit, and they had photographs, too. And the other group of planes saw that it was the hospital ship and left, and the weather had not changed. So the whole thing convicts the British. But like you say, it was January 1945. They said, hell with it. And they went along with this story that this pilot probably initiated in the beginning. It wasn't ordered by anybody. He made that decision. This just shows the way it is, the way it goes. But thank God that Josias has unearthed and made it. Maybe somebody else would have done a better job than him. But who would have been able to? Nobody who would have done a more honest job would have been allowed to do it. And still isn't allowed. So this is the best we've got. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of what I'm going to read in this book. What follows from this is a chapter called Epilogue. But it doesn't have anything in it that I think is important. He talks about this television special that was based on the book and kind of talks about what happened with his book and how it was accepted and so on. And he kind of preaches against war, and that's why he works with the United Nations. Well, what can we say? All in all, we have this book. I've said this too many times already. I'm glad we have the book, but it's sure far from perfect. But it also, because it is, it reveals very well the problem that we're up against. The problem that truth is up against, and the politicalization of this whole war, and who we have to see as the good guys and the bad guys. And of course, it's turned around as to what it actually was and is. I sincerely want to thank you for listening to these programs, and they will remain in the archives at carolynyeager.net for any future listeners and any re-listening. I'm grateful that I've been able to make these recordings, because there are a lot of people who would not read the book or read anything I wrote about it, but will listen because they, when they're driving or they're doing things, that they want something to listen to. So that's why it's good to have these recordings. So for the final time, for the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau 1939 to 1945, this is Carolyn Yeager, and my date of recording today is October 31st, 2015.